This panel discussion was recorded at the recent Western Australian Brewers Association conference in Perth. Brews News was able to attend to host and record these panels thanks to the generous support of Bintani. And we thank Bintani for their support, not only of us, but also those brewers in attendance at the conference and those unable to attend in person. Bintani, supplying the brewing industry with a wide range of quality brewing ingredients since 1995. Well, thank you, everyone. This one is, rather appropriately, when you look at the panel that we've assembled, is everything old, new again. The thinking behind this panel was, over the last 20 years of the craft beer movement, we've seen an acceleration in terms of innovation. And over the last, particularly 5 or 6 years, the style development that has come up, the way that brewers have been pushing boundaries, the way that we've seen hybridization of styles, it has been a very exciting time for the beer drinker. But are we starting to see the early signs that there could be some exhaustion, palate fatigue, or other things creeping in? And will we start to see a flight back to some of the classic beer styles? To discuss this issue with me, we have on the far right, Brendan Varis, the founder of Feral Brewing, and currently looking for interesting projects. We have Brian Fitzgerald from Artisan Brewing and Sean Simons from White Lakes Brewing. Thank you very much for joining us. Big round of applause for our panel. Brendan, is there any truth to the rumour that when you sold your brewery, it was because you saw the coming apocalypse of hazy IPAs and styles that you just could never see yourself making?
There's no truth to the rumour. I wish I had that much foresight, but that's where we find ourselves now, and I guess timing was good.
As somebody who's observing the industry, not necessarily being of the industry, what's your observation of the last 4 or 5 years of where beer styles have gone?
Broadly, I don't think it's changed a lot. I think we've now got a subset of IPAs. I think if the broad hoppy march goes on and on and on, and there's just now some new subsets within that. It's kind of how I see the hazy, juicy thing. I guess in terms of why they're so prolific, this will sound bad. They're somewhat easy, and certainly somewhat easier to make a reasonable example of them, not an excellent example, but a reasonable and an okay, acceptable example of a hazy, because there's lots of places to hide in that beer, in terms of, even if you just look at the description in the style guideline for hazy, in fact, any hoppy beer for that matter, lots of places to hide. You know, it almost sounds like a lambic. It can be garlic and onion and diesel, and you know, all those are acceptable. And sulfur compounds and all that stuff is okay. So I kind of put the march of the hoppy down to it's okay to get something that's reasonable. It's very, very difficult to make great lager. It's very, very difficult to make okay lager as well, much harder than okay.
And I take your point, and that's one of the criticisms that's often labelled at the brewing of those beers, but clearly there is an audience for them, and ultimately brewers will make beers that a market is calling for.
I think it's consumer-driven. They're not going to be made if there's not consumers pulling them off shelves, as simple as that. It's pulled. It's not being pushed, I don't think. But I don't understand the hazy bit.
Brian, just to set the scene, maybe tell us a little bit about your approach to brewing, because is it fair to say that you are a lover of classic styles?
Yes. So it's interesting hearing what Brendan's saying, and did a little research before coming here today, looking at World Beer Cup styles. When I graduated from brewing school 20 years ago, I went into a brewery and started making lagers as my first beer. But there we aged them for 3 months. It was a minimum that we never looked at speeding up the process or anything. But these were a lot of classic styles, Maybachs and Bohemian Pilsners and that kind of thing. So I really enjoyed it. Even though the brewery was called St. Arnold Brewing in Houston, I said, interestingly, you're not brewing any Belgian beers. And for me, that was the big thing. When I went through brewing school, I came out, the other students were interested in making IPAs and hoppy beers. And for me, I said, did you miss the chapter on yeast? This is really exciting stuff. And so that's how I approached it, was going to Belgium and looking at what they were doing there and finding very interesting things.
And how about you, Sean? What's your observations on the rapid evolution of beer styles that have emerged over the last half decade to decade?
I think, I don't think there'd be a tap room out there that wouldn't tell you that their biggest seller, or certainly in their top two, is probably the lager that they make or the Kolsch that they make. Because, that's what sells the volume. That's what makes the money and is the engine room, really, for the brewery to do all this other, this interesting stuff. I think that, a difficult thing for breweries as we move forward into the next sort of decade is that the cost to get to market for different styles and getting something that, it's okay to create all this different stuff, but getting something to stick is a real challenge, particularly in the retail space. Creating something that's just for your tap room is very easy. Putting it on tap, more difficult. There's not a lot of real estate out there, but getting a packaged beer to not just be a one-off release or a limited release, and then getting pull through is a real challenge, particularly from a cost point of view.
There was a lot of discussion during COVID, particularly that people wanted security of things that they knew, but we haven't really seen that so much in craft beer in a lot of ways, because I think the iteration of beer style has gone even faster, where you've got brewers talking about making 200 beers a year and releasing 200 beers a year if they've got multiple venues. My question is that sustainable, Brendan, do you think?
Look, there's a model for everyone. I don't know if every brewery tried to do 200 beers a year, then that's not sustainable. But if that's your thing to do small amounts of lots of different beers, there is a spot for some people to do that. And if they do them all well, then that's great. If their model is some type of size and scale and to do that broader distribution into a market, you're going to have to find a champion amongst those 200 and get behind it and hope that others get behind it for you as well.
Sean?
Yeah, I guess at White Lakes, we always set out not to actually compete in a fishbowl of 50, 70, or if you include the eastern states, hundreds of breweries that are all bringing out these different styles. And we saw an easier road, I guess, or more significant opportunity in actually competing with the bigger guys and putting our effort in building a brewery that had a little bit of extra technology and was sort of built around brewing lagers and brewing beers that were more difficult to make to compete against the majors and to sort of take a slice of the pie that that was easier to grab rather than being than fighting against all of our brothers.
As somebody who fell in love with Matilda Bay Redback back in the 80s, the first craft beer I ever had, and found it very hard to go back to lagers afterwards, and you had beers like Alpha Pale Ale and Little Creatures that really kick-started the craft beer industry. I saw the excitement that was created when people tried those beers as being the harbinger of a completely different beer industry that, in 10, 15 years' time, everyone would be drinking pale ales and things like that. And the needle seemed to freeze at about 10 to 15% on craft, and we haven't found it easy to move that too much. There's probably been bleeding, into the mainstream of the golden ales, the 150 lashes style golden ale, but lager still dominates. Do the three of you have any insights as to why that might be? Was craft beer never really for the masses? Hoppy craft beer never really for the masses?
Yeah, well, it's interesting you say that because it was back in the 30s when the majority of beer, 1930s, the majority of beer drunk in Australia was still ales, and it wasn't until refrigeration and we were able to develop these colder styles which were crisper and more refreshing, and it was really about the temperature here that I think that they took off and the ales fell away. And I think that Australia as a culture still sees that as being the, you know, that refreshing beverage that goes along with a meal and is something to have with your mates. So it's always going to be there, I think. For me, it's always going to be about drinkability and repeatability. So regardless of whether you've made a triple twisted IPA and with all the hops in the world, you can have one and think that that's really interesting, and you can see what the brewer's trying to do. But if you're not going to be having three or four, you put it down and you go, yeah, I can see what the brewer's trying to do, but I don't want another one, then that's where it stops, and that's not going to be a successful brand. So,
Brian, did you want to weigh in there?
Yeah, I agree with Sean what he's saying there. And one of the things that I remember studying the early larger lager breweries was they just wanted to make something clean and drinkable. And it was that cleanness that they often looked at. And that meant removing a lot of flavor and complications of the beer. So it was something that was easy drinking and something you could drink a lot of. So we saw ABVs come down and more adjuncts being used and to increase that drinkability. But I like the return to standard lagers now, full malt lagers, which are a really exciting space.
Brendan?
I guess is IPA or hoppy beer, pale ale, whatever, for the masses? Possibly not. I mean, still sitting well under 20% craft in the US, well under. And you know the numbers of what we are here in craft. Is there a moment where is there an opportunity for it to continue to grow? Yes, there's still a lot of work to do in terms of that beer being more for effect rather than flavour. You know, it's old chestnut, but still in Australia, most people, the majority of beer consumers are doing it for effect rather than flavour. So that's the old consumer education piece that never ends. It's not going to... I don't see it magically running up to 50%. It's just a long, slow burn. And with backing the diversity of what we do and people having choice, they won't all choose the same thing. And that's really what craft is giving the consumer, is the choice rather than just yellow and a bit fizzy and not very flavoursome.
But that in itself, there was such a reaction against the fizzy yellow liquid, as it used to be, that was derided, that breweries would almost refuse to make a lager because it was so derided. And now we are seeing a heavy uptick of not just pilsners, you know, the craftier, more assertive lager styles. We're seeing brewers who are proudly making Mexican rice lager, you know, and corn lagers and things like that. That was exactly what spawned the revolution, for want of a better word.
Yeah, I understand why lager was a no-go zone initially. We're still kind of growing into our pants a bit. And if we were making the same beer as the well-known existing two brewers in the market, then we weren't any different. So until we kind of were accepted as to what we were, and we're a real thing, and we do this, and this, and we can do lager really well also, it would have just been another explanation, another bit of communication, education that you would have to do when you would, you know, early doors, you were walking into a place and you might say that you're a craft brewer and they look at you like you had a couple of heads.
I think you're right. I think that it had to craft establish itself as this thing that was actually producing quality hoppy ales to differentiate it from, you know, there's no doubt that a big brewery and the guys that work in it, they're all passionate, they all love beer and they make a lot of beer really quickly at immaculate quality, and that's really hard to compete with. So craft had to establish itself as this different thing and higher quality thing before coming back to lagers, I think, and because they are more difficult to make. I think that you're right. If we everyone had gone out trying to make lagers against the big guys, craft would have never become anything. I don't know.
Brian?
Yeah, so, sorry, just before the coming here, I didn't get a chance to compile statistics from the AIBA, but I got some from the World Beer Cup. Number one, number of most entered categories, IPA. Number two, juicy or hazy pale ale, IPAs. Number three, German-style Pilsner. Wow, that was incredible. Then four was wood and barrel-aged strong stout. And then international Pilsner or international lager. And then Munich Helles, number six. So three of the top six there are all lagers.
Having been in the U.S. for that, every brew pub had a Pilsner on and a lager. And they were really good. So the quality was there. Is that one of the things that allows, to take up Brendan's point, there was an aversion to making lagers because you're competing with the big two, and how do you do that to some extent on price point? What allows small brewers to compete against the big two on their terms these days?
Yeah, I think it comes down to an experience. You go into a brew pub, and you're going to get your IPAs and your hazy IPAs and something that differentiates them from the marketplace. But if you bring in a lager and someone comes in and says, oh, I don't drink pale ale, I'm a lager drinker, and then you've got to give them something that's going to deliver. So I think it's all part of that experience. But as brewers, we all love lagers.
Maybe I'm looking at the wrong thing in those statistics, but when I hear that statistics about IPA and hazies, you hear that they're the most entered, highly competed in segments, and yet they're small niches in the market still. So if you've got too much competition in a small niche, I would imagine that it would be making it a fairly challenging place to be.
Yeah, I think it would be. But one of the beauties I see is that the hop growers are making something different, and brewers are making blends to make different flavors, whether citrus or tropical or could be any range of flavors. And you see these words pop up now, like caddy and diesel and onion. It was like, oh, that's delicious. We wouldn't have thought that.
Well, then again, there's wet dog and, wet dog and farmyard and horse blanket, and they're classic beer styles. So it's, just descriptions. We can acquire a palate for all sorts of things, Brendan.
Oh, we can. And I think today we can also, historically beer styles were what they were and tasted the way they were out of necessity, whether it was a type of water, so you're not going to try and make lager in the UK with your Burton-type water, or you didn't understand yeast, so that's why sour beers were made. But, they learned how to make them stable in Belgium. They realised how to for them to become stable over time, pre-yeast. So we now can do any of those anywhere. We've got the technology now. We can do the Burton water. We can do Pilsen water. And we understand the microbiology of sour beers, any other beer style we want. That's given the diversity, but how does the consumer actually want diversity? I guess it's a question. Like, do we just want some hoppy stuff, some bit of lager, and maybe a darker beer? I don't think anyone wants wheat beer. Is that all?
There was no way that this wasn't coming around to wheat beer at some stage. So you've addressed the elephant in the room. And the way that I'm going to bring it is, I was always amazed that in the early days of Feral White, a great interpretation of the Belgian wheat beer was your biggest seller, until Hop Hog came along and Feral White kind of disappeared off the map completely, I think. What is it about wheat beers that they were a foundational style for many craft breweries and they just didn't sell?
So going back to when we made Feral White, that was really at the early doors of American hops starting to become available. So there was probably only five or six varieties. Of those, maybe only three available in Australia. And there wasn't really any historical understanding about those beers, but there was about wheat beer. People knew that Germans drunk, they'd been to Oktoberfest and their big frothy glass, and so there was an understanding there, and you could reintroduce a small portion of people that knew about it to what they'd previously experienced. In the case of Feral White, falling by the wayside, that was like kind of mentioned earlier, it was 100% consumer driven. It's not like the resources got swung into behind this beer and left that one to, you know, all by itself. It was 100% consumer choice, and I think in terms of the timing for us, it was when, or those two beers, as the hops became more available, we used them more, and consumers chose them.
Sean, the wheat beer market, the wheat beer drinker too, is a weird section of the craft beer drinkers. They seem to be permanently there, and they never, you know, they never drink any more or any less. You seem to do, whether you're doing it on draft, you sell one. If you put it on a pub, right, you sell one keg a week, and every week it'll sell one keg a week, but it won't ever go to two kegs, and it'll never go to half a keg. So you don't really need to know it to do it. It's, there seems to be this small section of wheat beer lovers, and it's such a polarising style, but for most people it's just too much, too estuary. I think the biggest curse in the world is to win Abers with a wheat beer. It's just because you can't market it. You can't market it and actually turn it into anything good. But it is a lovely beer, though. Some of my favourite drinks in the hot weather is a Belgian wit, for sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to agree with you. I did like Redback when it was out. But my epiphany beer, I was in wine before I got into beer, it was a German Hefeweizen. And I'm like, this stuff's great. I never tasted banana and cloves in a way that was made it so delicious. But interesting, Artisan started in 2014 without a core range. We launched with a farmhouse red that was 8.2%. And we said, we'll just brew all of our favorite Belgian styles and we'll see what sticks. And now we have a core range in a Malabar wit or a wheat beer is in their core range. And that's what the customers wanted.
To stay on the wheat beer theme, how much do you think that because wheat beers were so obviously different from the clean lagers that they were distinctive and they stood out and they excited people, but then that yeasty fermentation flavour, you know, people are a little bit, you know, fermented foods that have that fermentation profile do tend to polarise because it's not obviously enough that it's meant to be sour the way that a sour beer is, but then it's just that little bit too fermented to be the clean lager. You know, is it one in that betwixt and between space?
Yeah, I mean, Brian can probably answer this better than me, but even, you know, those estuary styles still need balance. And I think too often smaller brewers who are doing a wheat beer wouldn't get that balance right and it wouldn't be crisp enough. And so you'd end up with quite a cloying example of an estuary beer and it really isn't drinkable, you know. I mean, it doesn't have drinkability, is what I'm saying. So you'll have one, but it's just too fulfilling. You just can't have more of them, and so that's why it doesn't tend to grow as a style, I think.
So what is should we be looking at what the next Franken style is, for, you know, hybrid style, merge style, evolving style is as the future of beer, or should we be looking back over, you know, into the history books? And I know that you've been struck by a new beer style recently, Brendan, that is a very old style, but it's really newly rediscovered. Should we be looking for old classics to resurrect?
Yeah, I feel like it's going to be both, like look back, but also see what's available, what new tools, whether it be ingredients or technology, is available. But certainly there's tens of thousands of years worth of brewing history there, which would be somewhat foolish to disregard and not look into what could be drawn from looking backwards. I think it's going to have to be a combination of both. And I think... As small brewers, it needs to be, I hope there's lots of small brewers out there looking for what the next thing is after hoppy. And I'll just say hoppy broadly, not just hazy, I just lump them together. Because at some point, the really big houses, the big breweries will be able to get a hop flavour not dissimilar to what a small brewery can and package it up and make it really cheap. And then if we've just all gone down this road of hoppy, what's left when you can get it from a big brewery cheaper and just as good and longer shelf life and all that stuff? They can't yet. There's technical challenges, but if they want to, they'll solve those if it gets big enough, right?
Brian, where do you looking forward or looking back?
Yeah, a little both. I agree with Brendan. I think that you have to look to the classic styles for inspiration, see why those became classic styles in the first place, whether it was due to the water or the malt or the hops or the yeast, whatever they had locally. But then exploring new flavors is always going to be on the horizon. So I remember listening to a podcast about Greg Noonan when he developed the hazy or New England IPA, but also he did black IPA at the same time. And black IPA didn't stick. It was popular with brewers, and when I drink it, I love it. But with the general public, it didn't go anywhere. But if anyone's brewing a black IPA out there, let me know, and I'll come and drink some.
Sean?
I think there's still going to continue to be this narrowing of alcohol content, more so because as excise continues to go up, that is just naturally going to be a ceiling that that brewers can play with to still have lots and lots of flavour, but achieve a cost price for the consumer that's still palatable. I don't think that if excise continues to increase, you're not going to be able to get 8, 9, 10% beers out there at any volume that you can afford to buy anymore. I mean, it's going to be $120 a case or $150 a case and whatnot. So I think the challenge for, we had some talks earlier about no alcohol and low alcohol and that growing market of 18 to 25s now, that's what they're looking for. They're not necessarily looking for alcohol and are on more of a health kick. So I think you'll see lots of different styles trying to play in that area where it's between 3.5% and 5%, but still with big banging flavour, still with as much hops as you can enjoy and as much bitterness. And so getting that balance right over the next couple of years in that smaller alcohol bracket, I think will be the challenge for the smaller guys.
Yeah, look, I don't love that idea, to be honest.
I didn't say I liked it.
I don't know if in terms of the small brewery, we need to pay so much attention to excise. I mean, we do already. Like, I think as an Australian industry, we've compromised based on our excise. It's based on strength rather than volumetric.
I would actually argue that Australian brewers are some of the best, sub 4% brewers in the world, because we've had to be, or you've had to be. I can't claim credit for that. But that excise pressure has actually created a whole specialty that doesn't exist in most other parts of the world.
Yeah, is that? But even our IPAs, they're all just IPA. They just tick over into enough to be kind of called IPA, or they might just be an American strong ale and you call them an IPA, whatever that case may be, because of our tax regime here versus how other countries are. So I've seen the effects of it already, but I don't know as small brewers who, like, those 7, 8, 9, 10% beers are rarely, if ever, going to be your rock star that your whole business is going to be driven around, like selling boxes and boxes of the same 10% beer. So as a one-off, I think, I'd like to think that you just design the beer the way you want it to be and you charge accordingly, and if you do a good job, people will pay for it.
Yeah, I don't see anything wrong with Belgian quadruple at 10 or 11%.
Well,
that's a low alcohol beer, technically.
But we are also seeing the rise of the abstainer and the sober curious and the many other terminologies that are going to be very confronting to the alcohol industry. Can you make beer that is interesting and flavoursome and has all of the enjoyment that a beer with alcohol has without alcohol? Do you think that it is the same product?
Enjoyment.
What's that?
You can't make it with the enjoyment.
So do we drink beer for the alcohol?
Oh, it's part of it. Sure it is.
I'm a curious fellow. I'm always drinking low alcohol or no alcohol beers. And my usual comment is, needs more alcohol.
Sean?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be a challenge. I think that alcohol is going to continue to, as the generations get older, I think people will drink less and less, or they will want to consume less alcohol in as a whole over a week, over a year. So I think that's going to continue to be a challenge, because it's the flavour enhancer in beer and a significant part of it. So I think that there's going to be some new challenges out there for brewers around flavour and alcohol. Yeah,
I might throw it over to the audience. Does anyone have any questions for this panel of old men? It's a relevant panel. It's a very relevant panel.
Love hearing you fellas talk about Redback. It's great. Just harking about the old days. Anyway, this is more a question surrounding customer observation and consumerism of, because you guys brew classic styles, that's what you've built your breweries around. Is it kind of a prevalence nowadays that a customer knows exactly what a beer is and they have this perception that, no, this is the right way that a beer is, anything else is wrong? I remember back in maybe 10 years ago, I drank a chocolate porter. This doesn't have chocolate in it. I must be wrong. Not the brewery's wrong. But is there a way that of like taking old styles and having to disguise them as something new? Or do you just blatantly go, no, this is what this beer is? And it's kind of an education process, as well as not, you know, letting someone else dictate what you do.
Look, I think that, you know, when I built White Lakes, it was really at the time it wasn't something that we necessarily set out to do. We set out to create beers that we like to drink, and I guess as that evolved and we started doing some of the more traditional styles, and you know, we've got a team of brewers that love hops as much as the next guy, and coming back to a more refreshing and drinkable beverage that you can have a couple of is also rewarding as well. So to answer your question in particular, I think that people certainly have a lot more knowledge nowadays, but it's also, in being better educated, they also realise that there's, you know, it's not a black and white line that you're making when you're making a particular style, and brewer's influence and nuance and whatever can actually take a pilsner and add some a great hop top note to it and turn it into something that's quite magnificent. Just because it's no longer a Bohemian style or German style pilsner, it doesn't necessarily make it a bad beer.
Yeah, I think it's just a communication piece. If you choose English pale ale, if you make an English pale ale and it's like a, you know, right off the bat stock standard one, that's what you call it. If you make the same beer and you use a spice or another ingredient, you label it accordingly with transparency, and you describe what you're doing and why you're trying to do it, and people will either enjoy that or not.
One of the things that I still really love doing is events, structured beer dinners, tastings, that kind of thing. As it is a lot about knowledge transfer, where you're trying to help people understand a style better, pairings with food, or the variances of a style, like you say. So it's always great to see an expression on somebody's face when they find a beer they've never tried before, or they didn't know something about it, and then say, wow, I really like that.
I just have from my own personal curiosity, I guess, on the topic of whether classic styles are coming back. Would you say that straight traditional styles seem to be re-emerging, or is it putting a modern spin on a classic style, reinventing it for a new audience that seems to be getting more attention? Reinventing it, I guess.
I think that we've come through this last 10 years, and everyone's, you know, everyone talks about the lupulin shift, where people's thresholds have changed back from, you know, when Little Creatures opened and Brendan with Feral. And we're now, our expectations really are for more flavour, I think. So if that is a trend that's happening, and there are, you know, more Pilsners or classic styles, I think you'll find that they will be hoppier, because that's just something as beer drinkers now that we expect, and also I think it, you know, people relate that to quality, you know, quality ingredients and quality additions. So.
I think it's a perspective thing. If you go back 20 years, you couldn't buy any classic beer styles at all, really, in Australia. You just bought the beer from Swan Brewery, and that was all there was available. Right here now, today, we could buy a great big chunk of classic beer styles of almost any sort. So in terms of are they coming back, they absolutely have compared to where they were in this country. So the diversity available to us is far, far better, and I think that's to be applauded, and just to not... you know, not just get caught in the weeds of, oh, it's all just one type of beer. Overall, thinking back over, you know, 20, 30 years, we're far, far ahead in terms of classic beer styles, all beer styles, being available for us to drink now.
G'day, this is a question for all three of you. What traditional or old style would you like to see more of on shelves? Personally, I really enjoy the smoked beer style, and the Feral Smoked is very, very nice.
Grodzicki.
Well, that's what I was alluding to before, and you didn't take the bait. Do you want to talk about it?
Oh, I guess we were just talking last night about a beautiful beer that I'd tasted, never tasted in out in the real world, I suppose. We tasted Judging here a couple of days ago. It was amazing. I didn't know. It's effectively a smoked, low-alcohol wheat beer with just very delicate esters, lovely mouthfeel.
And as we've established, low-alcohol smoke and wheat beers are just the things that sell.
Yeah, the question was, what would I like to see? No,
what's in your beer fridge at the moment? What have you been drinking during the week? And it can't be your own brewery or brewery that you used to own.
I'm drinking a bit of Bolter these days. What else? Still drink a bit of Creatures, Creatures Pale. As a just an old, I guess... No, I actually don't drink a lot of beer these days.
Brian?
I won't name any breweries in particular, because they're all really good. Maybe you understand why I served as Wawa president so long. But what I really like is local beer. So I travel a lot as a gypsy brewer. So when I'm in Margaret River, I look for Margaret River beers. And when I'm in the Great Southern, down there looking at their beer. So now I'm in Perth, and I'm enjoying the local beers here.
Yeah, I've got a smattering of local breweries, whether that be Eagle Bay. I've got some Boston stuff, some other side. It's mostly my own stuff, I think, just because of the cost upside. But every now and then, I also got given a gift of a nice wheat beer all the way from Germany by the Krones guys recently, so that's sitting there for my my weekend this weekend. But
that's unfortunately all we've got time for, so please a big round of applause for our panelists, Brendan Burris, Brian Fitzgerald and Sean Simons. Thanks to Bintani for making the recording of this panel discussion possible. Bintani, supplying the brewing industry with a wide range of quality brewing ingredients since 1995.